You know, I think all of us who teach, whether it is in the church or in a setting where we are given the responsibility to try to instill in others some sort of knowledge, have used what is called an object lesson. And if you're familiar with an object lesson is where you use something that a person can look at, identify, or see, and you can make an application from that and take that, and they can learn a specific truth or apply it in some way in their lives. I love how God often used object lessons with the prophets. If you go back to the Old Testament, for example, you go to Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 20, we find that God commanded Isaiah to go for 3 years with, most of our English translations use the word naked, to go around naked for 3 years, but it's believed that he wore a loincloth. And the purpose of that object lesson was to teach the children of Israel that God was going to use the king of Assyria to carry away the people of Egypt and Cush in that way, that they were going to be stripped down and they were going to be led away into captivity in that way. If you go to Jeremiah chapter 16, God commanded Jeremiah not to marry and not to have children. And the reason for that was because what God wanted to teach through that object lesson was that the coming catastrophe upon Jerusalem was one that was going to interrupt all of the normal relationships. One of the object lessons that you and I are most familiar with is found in John chapter 13, because it's there that Jesus, if you will remember, at the Last Supper, takes off his outer garment, wraps a towel about himself, fixes a basin of water, and begins to wash the disciples' feet. And then he tells them that they are to do as he has done for them. The object lesson is used to illustrate an attitude of service, that the servant is not greater than his master. And if he is the master and he's willing to wash their feet, they ought to be willing to do the same for one another. Tonight, we are looking in the book of Hosea. And you know what? One of the most interesting object lessons that I've ever come across in the Old Testament is found in this book. Because God commands Hosea to do something that we wouldn't tell anyone to do today. He says, I want you to go and I want you to marry. The New American Standard says, a woman of harlotry. Or a wife of adultery. I think the NIV translates it simply an adulterous wife. The King James uses the term wife of whoredoms. And God will use this object lesson and the children that come out of that to teach a very important lesson to the people of Israel. And what he tells us in verse 2 of chapter 1 is that God is trying to communicate a most valuable truth. The truth is that the land, the people of Israel, have committed flagrant idolatry, what he calls harlotry, in choosing other gods over him. Tonight I want us to look at the first three chapters of the book of Hosea and to see what God says to them through this object lesson and how it all plays out, and then try to make an application for us today. When you begin reading the book, you're introduced to Hosea. We're not told much about Hosea other than what we read here. We're told that his father was named Bere. Other than that, nothing more said about him. Some have suggested that he may have been a priest in view of his high regard for the duties and the responsibilities of the priesthood, but we really can't even confirm that. Another thing that we know is about the time he prophesied, because we're told in the very first verse that he prophesied during the reigns of four different kings. Now these are kings that are found in Jerusalem, Judah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahab, and Hezekiah. But then he also mentions a king in Israel, which is in the days of his prophecy. That is the king Jeroboam. He prophesied about 750 to 725 B.C., He is a contemporary with four other prophets, Amos, Isaiah, and also Micah. He and Amos were prophesying in North Israel. Isaiah and Micah were prophesying at about the same time down in Judah. Most likely, he was a young man, marriageable age when he began prophesying and saying the things that God wanted him to say. All of that being said, we're introduced in the first chapter to Hosea's family. God says to him, I want you to go, and I want you to take unto yourself a wife of harlotry. Or as I said earlier, the King James says, a wife of whoredoms. Her name, Gomer. I've always been interested in that name, Gomer. A woman named Gomer. What mother names her daughter Gomer? Maybe back then it was a popular name. Maybe it was a name that meant something. I don't know, but that was the name given to this woman. And that is the woman that he chose. Her father, Diblaim. And what we find here is that she is referred to as a wife of harlotry. There's a question. And scholars have struggled with it for years. The question is, was she a prostitute when he married her? Or was she an individual who was sexually pure at the time of their marriage, but then later began to engage in these things and to become an adulteress? And the truth is, we'll never really know. That is an argument that scholars have argued over for years. And while we can't be sure of her premarital condition, one of the things that we know is that this expression, wife of harlotry or an adulterous wife, anticipates what she will become as time progresses through all of this. She becomes a woman who is unfaithful to her husband. And her life, God uses to illustrate what's going on in the nation. And what's going on in the nation is that the people have become unfaithful to God. God had entered into a covenant with them all the way back at Mount Sinai. It had been reinstated when they first came into the land of promise. And now they are leaving that covenant that they've had with God for all of these years, and they're going after other gods, and they are literally committing spiritual adultery. To this relationship are born three children, or at least we think. The first one, as we are told, is a son. His name is Jezreel, but each of these names has a meaning. Imagine, if you will, for a moment, men, that you are married to this woman. And God tells you, you're going to have children. The first child you have, he says, name that son Jezreel. Now you know, because you're Hebrew, that the name has a meaning. And the meaning is this: God scatters, or God sows. What does that mean? Well, the meaning is this: it is a foretelling of the coming judgment of God upon His people. Because if you'll notice verse 4, He says, for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. God will scatter the house of Jehu. He will cause it to be no more. So that's the first message that through this first child that is born that is communicated. But then there are two more children that are born. The second one is a daughter. Now here's the interesting thing. We really don't know if this is his daughter or if it is the daughter of one of her lovers. Because if you'll notice, one of the things that is said about Jezreel when he is born is the statement that he went into her and she conceived, or it says she conceived and bore him a son. That's not said about the daughter. What it says is that she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. It doesn't indicate that he's the father, so we really don't know. But this daughter is given a name, Lo Ruhamah. It is a name that, as the others, will have meaning. It is a name, folks, that means no mercy. It can also mean she's not loved. Can you imagine giving your daughter a name, and the name means I don't love her? And every time that name is spoken in your home, every time it's spoken in the streets, people know you don't love her. At least that's the meaning of the name. And what God is communicating through this name is simply this: I'll no longer have compassion upon the house of Israel that I would ever forgive them. God is saying, I don't love you anymore. I'm no longer going to have compassion upon you anymore. I'm not going to forgive you anymore. It's a direct statement to the people of Israel because of the choice they've made to leave him and to pursue other gods. And then there's this third child, a son. And he too is given a name. And his name is Lo-Ami. And his name means this, not my people. So we have a daughter that says her name is in essence, I don't love you anymore. And a son whose name is, you're not mine. How painful that would have to be for a father to give names like that to his children, knowing what they mean and knowing the power that those names carry with them, because names in that day and time were powerful things. They carried a great deal of weight whenever they were spoken. And yet what God is saying through these children to his people is, once you were my people, once you belonged to me, once we were in a covenant relationship together, but now you're not mine anymore. I don't know you. You do not belong to me. And he even declares that, if you'll notice verse 9, because he says, you are not my people, and I am not your God. Folks, can you imagine how hard that would be if you're trying to serve God, to hear God say, you're not my people, and I'm not your God? You don't belong to me. I don't know you. I have no dealings with you. But by this time in their lives, it really didn't matter to them because so many of them had taken to serving the other gods anyway. And so what did the words of a prophet like Hosea really mean to them anyway? They were going to do what they wanted to do. So it is Israel's unfaithfulness that God is speaking out against, and he is condemning them for their sinful conduct. If you'll notice chapter 2, God in essence says through Isaiah, go and tell them to say to their brothers and their sisters, the Israelites, Ami and Ruamah. He's telling them, listen, verse 2, contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Men, I know that the woman seated beside you tonight is a woman that you love. She is your wife. Some of you, we've talked this morning about those who are celebrating anniversaries this week, 49 in one, 52 in another. But can you imagine saying to your children, go to your mother and tell her, you're not my wife. I don't know you. You see, the words that God is speaking through his prophet to his people are words that a husband, in his rage, who finds out that his wife has been unfaithful to him, will speak to his wife. They are words that he will speak, especially when he suddenly finds out that some of his children are not his children. That he thought, that's my child, that's through my wife and I, and finds out, no, I'm sorry, but you're not the father of this child. This daughter's not yours. This son is not yours. They're actually through another man. Are you serious? Are you telling me the truth? That these children are not mine? That we've been married for these years and these children were not mine? That's what I'm saying. They don't belong to you. They're from another man. Oh, they carry your name, but they're not yours. And this is what God is saying through this object lesson to his people. You don't belong to me. Your children are not mine. They belong to the gods that you have chosen to follow, but they don't know me, and they're not mine, and I'm not their God because you haven't brought them up to know me. You haven't instilled within them through your own life a love for me. And so what God says is that he's going to punish them for their sinful conduct. Beginning in verse 6 and going through the verse 13, he talks about how he's going to do this. He talks about hedging her up with thorns and building a wall against her. And he makes the point that she's going to pursue her lovers, but God is going to make sure that she can't find her lovers anymore. He's like the man going out and saying, I'll take care of him. You won't have to worry about him anymore because he's not going to be around. I'll make sure of that. Not only that, God is going to take away the blessings and the feast that Israel once had enjoyed. Can you imagine a husband finding out his wife's been unfaithful to him and saying, we're going to get a divorce and you can forget anything you ever thought you were going to get from me. I'll make sure you don't get a single dime. I'll make sure there's nothing coming your way. And he points out that he is going to destroy everything that Israel had used to commit her spiritual adultery. God is serious about the way they have treated him, as any man would be serious about finding the way he would respond to his wife when he found out that she had been unfaithful to him, or vice versa, a wife who finds out that her husband has been unfaithful to her and how she would respond in today's society. But now, here's the thing in all of this. And here's where it really gets interesting. Because of what God now tells Hosea to do. When you look at chapter 3, here's what God says. He says, Hosea, I want you to go get her back. But God, she's been unfaithful to me. I know. But God, she's got another man she's living with now. I know. I know. I want you to go get her back. Buy her back. Bring her home. Men, how would you respond to a command like that? Knowing what your wife had done, knowing how she had treated you, and knowing that your two youngest children are not really yours, but God says, go, bring her home. And so Hosea does that. If you'll notice chapter 3, that's exactly what he does. He goes out and he brings her home. He says, I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and for a homer and of grain, not of grain, but of barley, a homer and a half of barley. Now, I don't know exactly how this played out, and there's not enough information given. Some have said that what happens is that she has left him and that she's kind of followed this path of life as she's slept with man after man after man, till finally she is just looking for somebody that will even give her a roof over her head. And that Hosea goes and he literally buys her on the auction block back for himself as his wife. And he brings her home. And what he says to her is what we find here. He tells her that she's on a probationary period, if you will, that she must stay with him for many days, that she must not play the harlot, and she must not have another man in her life. It's only him from this point on. And this object lesson through all of this has been to demonstrate how God feels about the way he's been treated, how God has responded about the way he's been treated, and now how God has gone looking to bring his people back to him. Because that's what it's all about. God bringing his people back. His willingness to take them back if they will turn away from their spiritual adultery and come home. We struggle as we think about this when we put it in terms that we understand in our lives, don't we? That a man would ever consider bringing a woman back into his house after she had done that thing to him. That's what God tells him to do. And the whole purpose in all of this, God knows that this is the way she's going to behave. He knows this is what she's going to do. But the purpose in all of this is for God to communicate to his people, this is how much I care about you. I knew you would leave me. I knew you would be unfaithful to me. I knew you would go after other gods that were not gods at all. And yet I'm still willing to have you back. I still want you back as my own. And what he says in verse 5, looks to the future. Afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God, and David their king, talking about, I believe, the Messiah. And they will come trembling to the Lord and to His goodness in the last days. He says, they'll come back. I know they'll come back. How does all of this apply to us? Separated from this event by almost 3,000 years. A little over 2,700 if you want to be more exact. I think what we find in this object lesson is a message of the grace of God. Because God knows that, and He knew from time immemorial, that we were going to be unfaithful. He knew that sin was going to so damage our lives that it was going to put a barrier between ourselves and Him. He knew that His wrath was going to have to be poured out upon our sin. And He knew that if that wrath was poured out upon us and we received our just deserts, that it would mean our eternal damnation and a torment in a place which He had originally prepared for Satan and his angels. But God, as Paul says in Ephesians 2, being rich in mercy, saved us. And He did so by sending His Son. He didn't pay 15 shekels of silver for us. He didn't pay a homer and a half of barley for us. He paid a price that is so exorbitant that we can't begin to imagine the love that must have stood behind that for God to say, even though you don't love me, even though you have rebelled against me, even though you are weak and helpless, as Paul would say in Romans 5, I love you and I have sent my Son to pay the price to buy you back. Because I want you as my own. I can't imagine a more beautiful picture painted for us in the Word of God of the love that God feels for us. And when we read the Old Testament, we sometimes say, well, what is there in the Old Testament for me? What we see in the Old Testament is what God is like. You know, we think of God, people say, well, in the Old Testament, God is a God of wrath and God is a God who destroys people. Yes. We also see a God of great compassion and great love and a tremendous willingness to forgive when His people come home. You know, God calls us home. And we are called to live as His faithful bride, because that's what the church is. It's the bride of Christ. But for those of us here tonight that are Christians, there's an additional message, I think, in this. The additional message is this. It is that when a person who is a Christian wanders away from God, God doesn't just cut you off. God doesn't just say, I'm done with you. That's all I'm going to invest in you. I've done everything I'm doing for you. You've made your bed, now go lie in it. That's not the way God responds. No, God's response is still, come home. God's response is still, I know what you've done. I know how bad you've hurt me, but I still want you to come home. I want you to repent. I want you to put away your sin. I want you to get rid of that. And I want you to come home and be faithful to me, to live for me the rest of your days. Tonight, God extends His invitation to you. And He says to you, won't you come home? I love you enough to give more than you can ever imagine. My Son died for you. My invitation to you is come home. And whether you're an individual who's never come to Christ in obedient faith in your life, or you're an individual who has obeyed the gospel but wandered away, and has done things that you're ashamed of and know that you have not been faithful to God, his plea to you is, come home, because I want you home. If tonight you need to come home to have your sins washed away, repenting of a life lived apart from God, we are singing for you a song of encouragement. That's what it is, to encourage you, come home. And if you need to do so, won't you come right now as together we stand and sing.